Thank you, Bill. Thank you, Billy. Very gracious introduction. If we can get it in writing and notarized, I would pass it out. I'm delighted to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and to be here today, sober and reasonably happy and at one with myself and people around me. I'd like to welcome anybody that's new. I'm glad you're here. This is a baffling disease to me. I'm sometimes with what I can see in hindsight about myself and about my alcoholism, I'm often amazed that I ever made it out of the abyss. And it had to have been God's grace, which is in and of itself is odd because I didn't believe in God when I got here. And yet something I didn't believe in seemed to reach out to me and started doing things in my life. And I didn't understand it. I didn't know why I kept relapsing. But I really started to realize that I have a sobriety problem. And I have some other one of the things that created a feeling of difference between me and the people in AA is that it seemed to me from observation and listening in the meetings that alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous were bad, bad drinkers. I mean, I could match drinking stories with all of you. But the one difference, the thing that seemed to tell me that my case was different was that when you guys quit drinking and you came to AA, abstinence seemed to solve your problem. I came into Alcoholics Anonymous in Pennsylvania, and Pennsylvania and parts of Ohio have the type of AA meetings where there's a 30-minute speaker with a brutal drunk log, and then he comes into AA, puts a plug in the jug, and gets sober, and then his life is so wonderful, and then it's followed by another 30 minutes of comments where everybody tells you what an amazing guy this guy is, sober, and all his accomplishments. But I never understood that there was a process that connected point A to point B. It just seemed like they were automatic. It seemed like you put the plug in the jug and you were the wonderful guy. And I put the plug in the jug and I'm just not a wonderful guy. I am obsessively self-obsessed. I'm judgmental. I'm resentful. I worry about crazy stuff. I'm not right. And so I understood part of the equation. I understood that I had this thing that I must not drink. But I didn't think that it was alcoholism because when I didn't drink, it seemed like I got sick. I got depressed. I got anxiety to the point where at times I felt like I was having a nervous breakdown. I would build cases in my head against people. I would quit jobs because I imagined they were going to fire me. And to this day, I never know if they were or not. But in my mind, I imagined they would. I lived in my head in a world that is all out here that I can't seem to get to when I'm sober. And I liked getting to the world. I liked being a part of the world. I liked what Wilson said in his story when he was approaching this transformational experience of alcohol. He said he was a part of life at last. It was almost as if I get sober and I really miss the being here now. I really missed the ability to connect with people. I really missed shedding the anxiety and the depression and being able to step out into life and be a part of. And I think that's why I drank, really. I drank for, as Carl Jung said in a letter to Bill Wilson, we drink for unity, wholeness, because I'm not right. And alcohol was the medicine. And I didn't understand from observation and from listening to you that alcoholism, if you're a real alcoholic, it chases you up into your abstinence like a pack of rabid dogs and gnaws at you and nips at you until you eventually cave and go back to, as Silkworth says, succumb to the desire again to drink, and because it wears you out. My alcoholism emotionally would wear me out. I hated the feelings I would incur sober, and longevity from abstinence didn't seem to help it. It seemed to exasperate it sometimes. You know, and maybe some of you are like me. You get sober and I'm in a treatment center. I have hope. I'm gonna change my life. I'm gonna go back to, maybe I'll go back to school. Maybe I'll get a good job. Maybe I'm gonna do this. I'm gonna do that. And then as time went on, whether I did any of these things or not, all the excitement, all the hope just seemed to bleed out. Because if I did some of the things, if I got the good job, it's funny because it seems like a good job until I'm there a while. And then it's not a good job anymore. And I don't know why. I don't know why. It looked like a good job, but it's not really. It's not a good job. And I get a girlfriend who looks like an amazing girlfriend. Oh, just amazing. Changed my life kind of deal. You know, 3 weeks later, it's, I'm like chronically disappointed. You know, and I don't know what's wrong with me. And what happens is I get so delusional, and I lose all my hope, and I start to implode into a depression. And I've been diagnosed as clinically depressed. I've been diagnosed a lot of things, and I get it. I cut a copy of one of the DSMs, and the way if I explain the way I feel when I'm a newcomer to a psychiatrist, he's going to write me a prescription and give me a diagnosis. I mean, that's just the way it is. Because and I'll tell you a funny thing. It was not clinical depression. It was not free-floating anxiety, panic disorder, type of neurosis. It was not any of that stuff, even though it looked like it. And what it was, and I would have never imagined this, and if you would have tried to tell me this, I would not have believed you, and I would have gotten mad. But what it really is, it's a malady of my spirit, of my very being. And out of that came a great hope. In our book, it says that when the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. And that has been true for me. But it wouldn't have looked like a possibility on the other side of the actions. On the other side of the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't look like it would work. Until you work it. Until you do it. I mean, when you think about it, who would have imagined that the chronic depressive that I am could be freed from that by helping others. Helping others makes no sense. I'm the one that needs help here. And yet, when I take the actions, I start to get that thing that happens to all of us that throw ourselves into service in Alcoholics Anonymous and 12-step work. You start to get the only freedom that really matters. And there's only one freedom, and I think it contains everything that we imagine freedom to be, but it's in one freedom, and that's the freedom from the bondage of self. And who would have thought that the thing I drank for, freedom from, the thing that plagued me and smothered me in my abstinence to the point where I always went back to drinking, who would have imagined that that I would get free from that by helping others. Didn't make any sense. When you know deep inside yourself that you're the one that needs help, I'm the one that's messed up here. How could helping others help a guy? I mean, and I remember saying to my sponsor in 1978, I wasn't even out of detox. It was somewhere, I think, in the first week, and he wanted me to start going on 12-step calls. He wanted me to be one of the guys coming back. And because I'd had so much exposure to psychotherapy and read a lot of books, and I was full of a lot of useless information, I said to him, well, don't you think I should work on me for a while? And his response was beautiful. It looked like he bit into a lemon. The look on his face is, work on you. You've done quite enough of that. Stop it. And I got it. And I thought, you know, I have worked on me a lot. And the more I work on me, the sicker I get. And I guess that's why I can't really rise much above my defects of character on my own power. I can't rise up against my obsessive inclination for self-involvement much on my own power. I can't really do much here on my own power. But I play a part. And God plays a bigger part. God does the heavy lifting here. And what God did for me is I don't even understand this. And I've thought about it. And sometimes I think I understand it. And I'm not sure I really do. But something happened to me. And all of a sudden, for the first time in 7 years of relapsing, 7 years of being exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous, for the first time, I was willing to be sponsored by someone. And I was willing to follow their directions. And that was a game changer for me, because I have an ego that becomes louder and more needy and more driven in my abstinence. And consequently, it drives me right out of AA. It drives me right back into drinking. It drives me into insanity. It drives me into hurting people that I don't mean to hurt. It drives me. But it drives me just the same. And it's like when you get a sponsor in Alcoholics Anonymous and you start not making any decisions without at least talking to him about them, it's an amazing dynamic, because it dissipates the driving force in your life. And now, unbeknownst to me, he's giving me things that are spiritually principled in nature, like weird things, like don't punch your boss and quit your job. Make amends to him. Well, that's not a course of action that would occur to me. Make amends to him. He should make amends to me, for God's sakes. He disrespected me. You know, it's like crazy stuff that doesn't make sense. And I was lucky to make it with a sponsor. I think I needed a keeper when I got sober. I'd come up with crazy ideas. I mean, crazy ideas. Before I got out of the detox, I've already decided that I needed medication for anxiety, for depression, and to sleep, because I have a hard time with all that stuff. My sponsor said, no, 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 no. You're going to find out if Alcoholics Anonymous will work for you without any chemical aid. And I followed his direction, and little things, you know, I had a little plan that was, you know, I'd struggled. I couldn't get a good job. And I finally took a job he didn't want me to take. But prior to that, I thought to myself, you know, I understand I can't take a drink no matter what, no matter what. And I can't safely use drugs. That always ends up back to drinking, back to me and burning my life to the ground. Okay, I can't do that. But why couldn't I sell drugs sober without ever using them? People make a lot of money doing that. It seemed like a great plan. And that's why you need a sponsor. You need to explain these plans to your sponsor. Because if nothing else, its entertainment value is endless. I mean, that's why I love sponsoring guys, because especially when they're brand new, because they have some ideas. Oh, do they have some ideas? And they don't think they're humorous, and they don't even think they're bizarre. I didn't think my ideas were bizarre. Now I do. And so when I was able to become sponsorable, it was the turning point. And I get the steps are really essential, but before I even really got into the steps in any depth, I had to surrender to Alcoholics Anonymous. And ultimately through that and sponsorship and the working the steps, I surrendered to God intermittently. I say that because in my experience, the surrender may be the solution to my spiritual malady, but like every other solution in the universe, has a tendency to evaporate. And I think that is tied somehow into the chronic nature of my alcoholism. I love Harry Thiebaud and some of the things he talks about, because they seem to ring true in my experience. When he talks about how we must have ego reduction at depth, is that I got to get smaller here. I got to get humbler here. I got to stop being the I know everything guy. I got to start listening to you, right? Because I know alcoholics of my type, we don't listen. We don't even understand the dynamic we were born with. I was born with 2 ears and one mouth. Like God was trying to tell me something, and I need to listen to you. But how often in my early sobriety, and sometimes today, I'm embarrassed to admit it, but sometimes today, I'm not really hearing you. You're talking to me. I'm just waiting for you to shut up so I can say something profound, right? I'm waiting to hear from the smartest guy in the room, you know? I'm the idiot, right? That just taking that position is I'm an idiot. And yet my ego resurfaces, because what Harry Thiebaud says has been true in my experience is the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. It's so bizarre that a guy like me can be brought to my knees and be surrendered by life itself in sobriety as a result of making some bad decisions based on self. And I can be humbled and brought to my knees and get to that place, you know, that place where you don't know and help me and I'm sorry and I was such an idiot. And you know that place. You can't stand yourself and you're turning to God and you're turning towards your sponsor. And it's a wonderful place. It's a place of humility. It's a place of where you know the most important thing you'd ever know is you really don't know. And you're, again, you've returned to the position of being sponsorable again, which in other words, you've pulled your life out of the hands of the idiot and you've returned it to someone that God might work through to help you. I loved listening to my dear friend Sandy. I love Sandy. Sandy one time said, his sponsor told him, you don't have to turn it over to God. Just give it to anything that will take it. Right? Anything. Just doesn't matter. Anything. Just not you. Just not you. And I get that, you know. And then here's the craziness. I've gotten to that point of demoralization. I like what it says in the book on, I think it's on 52, where we were crushed. And this happens in sobriety to guys like me. I think it happens more distinctly in sobriety than it did when I was drinking, because I can hang the crushing and the consequences of my drinking on my drinking. But when you're crushed sober, you can't blame the drinking. It's you. You made decisions based on self, which later placed you in that position to be hurt. You did it. You start to get it. You know, if the CSI team came into this mess, they're only going to find my DNA. And so crushed and humbled, I'm in a great spot. But it doesn't last. It never lasts. you know, a week later, you know, I'm the smart guy again. A week later, I'm out of the woods. A week later, the consequences are off my back. A week later, I know I intellectually, I can't manage my own life. But watch this. You know, and it's crazy. And so I'm that guy, and I suffer myself in sobriety for a number of years. And I didn't understand what was happening to me. I didn't understand. And I would say things to people, and sometimes in meetings, in discussion meetings, I would say, well, I turn it over and I take it back. I turn it over and I take it back. And I turn it over and I take it back. And one of the things that Bill says coming out of the backside of this vital decision we make in step three, he says it has little permanent effect. It's the chronic nature of alcoholism. It has little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves that have been blocking me. And here's what I glean out of that, that it's a once and done situation. And it's not. But when I finally, after being sober a few years, and I finally, after, you know, several exposures to Joe and Charlie and some of that stuff, and I started to understand what to do, and I started going back through the steps again, this time following the big book. I really followed, especially on the fourth step. And not so much in six and seven because I didn't understand them, but in step four and five, I was right along the lines with the book. And it was a transformational experience. And it facilitates the decision that on my own, I can't carry out. And not from a lack of intention. I went through a period of after saying that third step prayer, I incorporated it into my life. I'd get up every single morning, and I did this for decades. But it was so demoralizing in the beginning because I'd get up in the morning, I'd get down on my knees, I would say the third step prayer, I would talk to God, and I would do all of this with the full and genuine intention of giving my will and my life to God, to His care. And discover that in short order, I'm back in my head in the control center, trying to figure everything out and run the universe. There were mornings where I would turn my will and my life over to the care of God, supposedly, according to me. And, I, 40 minutes later, half hour later, I'm in my car driving to work, having conversations in the car with people that aren't in the car. And it's all acts of management. It's all me trying to wrest some satisfaction and happiness out of this world by management, by figuring, by maneuvering, by solving problems that haven't even occurred yet because I'm scared and I'm trying to protect myself. And the anxiety of that was difficult. It was difficult. I remember going and talking to an old timer in this period of my sobriety where I was struggling with the intention to give my will and my life to God and finding the inability to carry out the decision. And I went to talk to this old guy. He passed away with a little over 50 years. And he said, well, your problem is not faith. And he said, because I told him, I pray every morning. I say the third step prayer. I pray at night. You know, I pray it sometime during the day. He said, well, you believe in God, but your problem is not a lack of faith. It's a lack of trust. And trust isn't, and I've discovered trust isn't a feeling. It's an action. It's my angle of approach in life. It's my attitude. And it's demonstrated by what I do, not by what I feel. And he told me a story too that really, really shined a light on an understanding on the difference between what I was suffering from and what was lacking. It was the difference between faith and trust. And he said, if you went to a circus and you sat in the audience and you watched a tight wire actor, it'd be very easy to watch a tight wire walker, a professional guy who walks across tight wires at the top of the circus tent, and you'd see him come out to the platform. He's pushing a wheelbarrow. It'd be easy to have all the faith in the world. That guy can walk across that tight wire pushing that wheelbarrow. You'd say to yourself, wow, he's done it 100 times. He's a professional, absolute faith he can do it. But then if you trusted him, you would get in the wheelbarrow and let him push it across. And when he said that to me, this was probably 40 years ago. It was like a light went on. I get it. See, that's the problem. I believe in God because it's I'm supposed to and it's convenient. But I guess I don't really trust him. And I tell you, over the years, that's been a big thing with me, is learning to trust God. It's because it's all that matters here. Because as a guy told me when I was really new, and my sponsor had me praying, even though I don't believe in God, he had me taking the actions of turning my consciousness towards a possibility that I didn't really believe in. And I was praying even though I don't believe in God, and this guy came up to me and he told me I needed to take step 3, and I told him I couldn't because I don't believe in God. And he said I didn't have to believe in God to take step 3, and that all I had to do was get it out of the hands of the idiot. That I could turn it over to anything. The chair, he said, he pointed to a chair in the Alano Club. And said, it's all about that. And I understood that. And so when I'm saying the third step prayer on my knees, because of hyper self-interest, I want to get my life out of the hands of the idiot because I want a better life. It was a very self-serving and self-seeking proposition for me. Unbeknownst to me, I thought it was spiritual. But it was really about my relief and my life and what I'm going to reap out of life. Because I understood, I watched people and listened to people in meetings, and it seemed to me that the people that surrendered and turned their will and their life over the care of God had miracles. And they always got a bigger piece of the pie. You know what I mean? You hear those stories, you know. I was about to be homeless and I couldn't get a job, and I surrendered. I prayed. I surrendered my life to God, and now I'm the president of United States Steel. Or, you know, you hear these stories that was like, what? Well, I get it. I hear enough of those that, you know, my selfishness grabs onto this stuff and I want a bigger piece of the pie. And what I didn't realize is that I suffered from this bondage of self. You know, there's an old adage. I think that's why service, it's one of our three legacies, but it's also a big piece of the recovery legacy too. It's the accumulation of the 12 steps is in step 12, which makes perfect sense why Wilson refers to it as our primary purpose, because without step 12, without service, without helping other drunks, the first 11 steps is just another self-seeking, self-serving endeavor. If my program recovery is only benefits me and is all about me, it's just another exercise in selfishness. And so what I started to discover by making a lot of mistakes and doing a lot of things that were in conflict with that thing inside me, the book refers to it as the great reality deep down inside me. You know, I've always had a moral compass inside of me. I just don't like the way it points sometimes. This looks better. I know it's pointing over there, but this is what fun's over here. The right thing's over there, but that's the right thing. Don't I? There's plenty of time for the right thing later. This looks better. And that's all. I am unlike a lot. My daughter has an impeccable and uncompromisable moral compass. She would never, it would be out of line for her to consciously do something that was against her principles. Me, on the other hand, I'm maneuvering all. I know I shouldn't do this, but if I could figure a way to do it and not, and keep the consequences down to something minimal. You know, I'm that guy, right? I'm a maneuverer. Self-seeking, self-centered, selfish people always are. And so I started maneuvering, and what I discovered, I'd make all these mistakes, and there's an old adage that seemed to prove true for me experientially, is that God doesn't punish me for my sins. I'm not punished for them. I'm punished by them, because they change the way I feel about myself. And as a depressive, I get that, because I suffer from myself. I take myself, my selfishness takes me hostage, and I'm the one that pays the price. And if that seems to be as consistently true in your life as it has been in mine, that I'm not punished for my sins, I'm punished by them, then there's the antithesis of that would also be true. I'm not rewarded for my service in my 12-step work. I'm rewarded by it. And to make the connection that is, this is the stuff, and these are the actions, and this is the positioning that relieves me of the bondage of self. And it's funny, when I'm spending time with some new guy, and I've been doing that a lot lately, I've got a couple brand new guys, thank God. And when I'm spending time with them, and I'm like, whether it's talking about step one and trying to get them to find their alcoholism and within the phenomenon of craving and all, you know, every, you know, all this stuff. Basically, the interviewing process it talks about in working with others is I'm doing a version of that, trying to get them, you know, through the first two steps at least to get up to step three. As I'm trying to do that, it's funny, even if it takes an hour or if it takes 4 hours, in that period of time, I'm not worried about nothing. In that period of time, I feel free. In that period of time, it is often an intermittent connection with God that facilitates something I have no power to facilitate on my own. And you know what that is. Those of you who sponsor people, you're trying to help some guy, and all of a sudden something works through you. It's not of you, but it's through you. You know, when you all of a sudden you hear yourself say words to a guy you've never said before, and there's a rightness about him that resonates, and you know that is not you. You're not that smart. It was not of you, but through you. From the great reality deep down within me. And you know how I unlocked the channel to the God within me? By getting me out of the way, and that guy got me out of the way. He freed me from the bondage of self, and God becomes present. That's always been the problem for me. And it was years in sobriety before I started to understand this, that I got too much of me between me and you, and I got too much of me between me and God. And if I want to get closer to God, I got to remove the separation between me and his children. That's why, isn't it? It's so odd in AA, but in today's experience, it makes perfect sense, but it didn't for a long time. Why all the actions we're asked to take in Alcoholics Anonymous that ultimately bring us to what the book refers to in the fifth step promises is we begin to have a spiritual experience. We feel the nearness of our Creator. And all the actions we take up to that point are not actions trying to go towards God. They're actions trying to move away from us and get close to his kids. massive self-reduction, and the fourth step, I think, is the first thing I've ever found. And I went to a lot of therapy prior to AA, a lot. But it wasn't until I did the fourth step out of the big book that I really hit this method of massive self-reduction that Harry Thiebaud talks about. As I went through every resentment, and I had a long list of judgments, and I was sober a while when I made my first really good fourth step out of the big book, and I had all these judgments, these resentments, and most of them were, a lot of them were people in AA, because I'd been in AA now a couple years. And as I went through the process of on page 66 and 67, and looking at it from an entirely different angle and putting myself in their shoes and seeing that even though I didn't like what they did and how it hurt me, that these people were like me, that I'm not smugly superior. Well, I'll tell you, when I started doing that, looking at it from their side of the street, and started looking at my problems with my mother and father through their eyes and what it must have been like to be in their shoes. Man, was I wrong about my mother? I blamed her for a lot. Was I wrong about my father? But man, was I wrong about my sister? Was I wrong about the bosses and the girlfriends and the buddies that I thought turned on me? When I started to see it from their side of the street, it was a huge awakening, and contained within the awakening was massive ego reduction. Because I started to see it from your side of the street. Now I know why my parents, in broken hearts and frustration, cut me out of their life. They couldn't take it anymore. What I didn't understand is how they took it as long as they did. How they kept bringing me back into their home and let me steal from them. How they kept trying to bail me out even though I just would get worse. What I didn't understand is how tolerant and forgiving and accepting and loving they've been to me, because I get it. I'm so selfish. If the tables were turned, I would never keep showing up for a guy who treated me like I treated my parents with the consistency my parents did until I eventually pushed them out of my life. They couldn't take it anymore. And the same with the bosses. When I looked at what happened, I blamed them for everything. I looked at it through their eyes. I knew why they fired me. My God, what I didn't know is why they gave me a second chance. I wouldn't have. And every time I processed a resentment, which is a judgment, it's the thing the ego does the best. It plays God, the judges. Every time I broke one of those down and I looked at it from an entirely different angle, it was like a ratcheting down. I was wrong about that. I was wrong about that. I was wrong about it. And it's like you're growing smaller. And as I grew smaller, what it said in the fifth step promises was true. I came out of the backside of the fifth step with a sense that maybe God and I are okay. But maybe I feel him now a little bit more in my life. It's moving more from faith into actual some intermittent conscious contact. I remember having, after my first fifth step, having moments where I felt that God loved me for no reason that I could ascertain, because even though I still did not feel really lovable, I understood that God loved me. And what happened, you know, with that and me, is to reduce the separation between me and me, there was a whole bunch of work to be done in step 9, and a whole bunch of work to be done in service and helping others in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went to a lot of great psychiatrists trying to changed the way I felt about myself because I was such a depressive and so what seemed to be self-destructive. And how do you change that? If you have a deep-seated self-loathing, how do you change that? Well, I changed it by immersing myself in a life of service and other-centeredness and altruistic actions and going and paying people back all the difficult, hard, inconvenient actions of step 8 and 9 and 12. I think the combination of step 8 and 9 and 12 has changed me more than anything. Because if you act like someone consistently over a long period of time that you would respect, you end up feeling that way about yourself. You know, I was a parasite. Yeah, I was a user of people. And yeah, I was a dirtbag. But my God, I have several years now of paying back the money and help, being inconvenienced and help, going out of my way to help people. And it changed the way I felt about myself. And I guess that's important for a couple reasons. One is that it's hard to receive love, whether it's from the people in AA or God, if you secretly feel like you don't deserve it. And unbeknownst to me is that the actions that you guys had me take was repositioning myself in order to be a receiver of help in AA. I had a hard time for in AA for a long time receiving help. I mean, I did in the beginning. I received in the beginning because I didn't have any choice because I was down and out. I was just off the streets and I was homeless, but I didn't like it. I felt diminished when you helped me. And after a time, I don't even know when it happened, but after a time, I started enjoying receiving help because I was awake to something. I was awake that you were helping me and you got out of helping me what I got out of helping you. And it's time to share the wealth. And I could receive help and give it. And they're both good. But when I was the ego, the really entrenched in the egomaniac with the inferiority complex, it's hard to receive help because you feel diminished. You know, in the Japanese language, they have several phrases that they use to express a gratitude towards someone who helps them out of a jackpot, out of a bad situation. But if in the English, all of these would translate into a different form of resentment. Because if you helped me, I lost face because you shouldn't have had to. And it's a very ego thing, but you shouldn't have had to, as if I had any class or if I had any, some, you know, I wouldn't have been in this spot, or I would have gotten myself out of this spot. That the pride just about kills guys like me. That's why it's such a big point on the column on page 65 in the resentment inventory. There was a great man in Alcoholics Anonymous. He died with 55 years, I think, in here in Las Vegas, Ted. And Ted used to say, yeah, there's seven deadly sins. There's pride, lust, and five others. I would always think, isn't that, that's about right, you know? Those are the two that haunt me, is pride and lust. And Alcoholics Anonymous, you guys have changed me. Now, that doesn't mean that I couldn't change back to be at my worst again. I could. I've seen it happen to a lot of guys. I like to, Al says something I really enjoy a lot, where I'll never be too sober not to get drunk again. But I can get too drunk to ever get sober again. And I've watched guys who drink with more time than I am. I have, and I've watched, and it's almost like the longer I'm sober, the more I need AA, and the more I have to lose. Because I know what happens to a guy that's over 40 years of drinks again, he don't get back. I've tried to 12-step a couple of them in our detox. The disease progresses. And you know, one of the saddest things to watch is a guy who'd had double-digit sobriety drink again, and then he's doing everything that got him the double-digit sobriety, only it's not enough anymore. It's the disease has progressed unbeknownst to him, and now the game, the ante has been upped in the game. And he don't know it. And he doesn't understand why doing the amount of meetings he did the last time and doing the actions he did the last time, why it's not sustaining him this year, this time. But this is a progressed case of alcoholism. I really believe what it says in the book. I've watched it. But over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. I've watched that, and it's a horrible thing. So I have a lot to lose here, because I know guys like me don't get back. You know, first of all, and I know there's a lot of people in this meeting that are sober a long time, and you all know, if you drink again, everyone you don't like in AA will line up to give you advice. You know, what a sobering thought. And with the progression of the ego, they may be giving you the advice you need, but you won't be able to hear it because you'll be the I know guy. And I that terrifies me. I've seen it happen to other people, and I believe that if I have the same spiritual and physical and mental malady that you have, then what happened to you could happen to me. I'm not bulletproof. I'm not above it. You can't get above your alcoholism here. You can't mentally outgrow it. You can't physically outgrow it. You can't abstinent yourself away from it. It is a chronic illness. It rides with me. And I got to have God riding with me, and I got to have you riding with me. Because if without you and without God, all that's left is me and my alcoholism, and it would overcome me. I'm going out to, this is my second, this is my third meeting today. My second Zoom meeting, and I went to a live meeting every once in a while, and I know everybody I've ever known has had this experience, where every once in a while you go to a meeting, and by the time the meeting's over, you really feel like you need a meeting. And I had that experience today. That hasn't happened in a while. But I don't know what my first sponsor had a tremendous view and ethic on Alcoholics Anonymous. This meeting I came from was a meeting where you volunteer to share, which I get it. If you're 30 days sober, you think your name is, does anyone want to share? I mean, I get that. But my first sponsor, I'll never forget this. I was only sober. Well, it was the Christmas holiday. So I was only sober probably a couple months. And they had an Alcathon, which is where they have marathon meetings round the clock on a holiday, right? And every group in the area gets a slot, gets a time slot. And my home group had a time slot, and they asked me to chair the meeting, which was intimidating because I had never chaired a meeting before. And this was a big deal. This is the holiday marathon, and oh, my God, my whole home group's going to be there. Whew. And I'm nervous. And I was asking my sponsor, you know, right before the meeting was going to start, I said, well, who do I call on? Because I'm not real sure what to do, and I don't want to make a mistake. Who do I call on? And I'll never forget this. He said, well, we don't want to hear from anyone who really wants to share. And I never forgot that. And that is proven to be true to this day. Because what presumes that you need to hear what I got to say? What? It's not my spirit. My spirit doesn't presume anything. It's my ego. And so I have a hard time sometimes with meetings. And it's been so ingrained in me. It's hard for me to volunteer to share because there's a feeling of willfulness about it. You know what I mean? But if I'm just sitting in a meeting, minding my own business, trying to listen, and someone calls on me, I don't have a problem with that. Maybe that's God. I don't know. But it's not me. And that's the important thing. I don't know if it's God or not, but I do know it's not me. And that's good. So Alcoholics Anonymous has been labeled a lot of things that it isn't. I was at an H&I meeting at a men's facility. I've been going to a lot of these H&I meetings lately. I've opened the places back up, but I went to one that was very disconcerting to me. And the reason it was disconcerting, everyone who came in from AA supposedly to do this panel, they all shared as if they were sharing in an NA meeting, and it made me very uncomfortable. And I've often thought, if we're just gonna randomly allow people to go and represent Alcoholics Anonymous in H&I or CPC. Or PI, that if they're going to represent Alcoholics Anonymous, and I know in theory that no one represents AA, but in actuality, sometimes those people are the only example of Alcoholics Anonymous, a newcomer or a professional or someone in the classroom at a PI talk will ever see. And we send people out to do this without any workshops or training or anything. And every time I see some weird stuff go on I've seen it in a CPC meeting where it was just horrible, and I've seen it in some H&I, I often think that we really need to provide some workshops on not just what AA is, but what it isn't. That we're not all things to all people. And that if you're not an alcoholic, I'm not going to try to convince you you are, or that it's all the same disease, because it's not. And if I do bring you into Alcoholics Anonymous and you aren't really an alcoholic, you probably will never recover here, where you could have went somewhere else where your case wouldn't have been different. And maybe connected there through identification. Our book says that until this understanding is met, one alcoholic to another, very little can be accomplished. And so I'm going to a little dinner tonight with a bunch of guys, some people I sponsor, and it'll be like a little meeting. We're going to go do some touristy stuff. And tomorrow I'll get up and I'll do my 2 hours in the morning, and I'll go to some meetings that are scheduled tomorrow that I'm going to go to, one live and one Zoom. And then Tuesday's my big day because I do an H&I meeting and then a meeting in my backyard with about 80 people. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the purpose in my life. I know who I am today. My name's Bob, and I have alcoholism. What seems to have turned out to be God's greatest blessing. I thought it was the greatest curse at one time, but it's turned out to be the greatest blessing because it is the thing that drives me, shoves me, and pushes me sometimes resistantly into becoming more than what I am. And I am an alcoholic, and I know what my life's about. I like a loose cannon, I wondered for years, what am I supposed to do? How much money am I supposed to have? Where am I supposed to live? None of that's important. I'm not only an alcoholic, but I have a purpose in my life, and my purpose has been divinely crafted by God to help people like myself. Can't help everybody, but I'm pretty good with people who suffer from alcoholism like I do, because I can make that connection with them that I made with my first sponsor in 1978. And it gave me hope that maybe if I followed him around and did what he did, maybe what happened to him could happen to me. Mark Twain, I'll end with this. Mark Twain said something that I've really come to love. I've been sharing this a lot because I think it's the most amazing thing. Mark Twain said, the two most important days in any human being's life is the day you were born and then the day you realized why. I don't think there's anything greater than a purpose in your life. Thanks for listening.